Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roering, Jacob Kanzler, Jack Spencer. We've got some special guests. It's our before election pollster panel, and we've got Steve Mitchell from Mitchell's Research and Communications, Tom Shields from the Marketing Resource Group, and Mark Grebner from Practical Political Consultants. Steve, you were up late last night. You're still doing some last-minute polls. What are you finding right now?
Well, it looks as though the Democrats are going to have a good night on Tuesday night. Both of the statewide offices, they've got pretty good leads in, and so I think the Democrats will do well at the top of the ticket, as has been the case in 18 out of the past 20 elections. During the midterm, the party out of power generally does pretty well, and I think that's going to be the case this year.
How big is the sweep going to be, Mark?
Well, statewide, I'm kind of guessing that the Democrats take about 55% of the two-party vote. So that's enough that unless there was a really strong Republican incumbent, which there isn't for any office, there really isn't any chance of a Republican winning statewide on the Republican ticket. I mean, I'm not talking about the Supreme Court.
But, yeah, I was going to go there next.
Yeah, but everybody who's got a Republican Party next to their name, there's no realistic chance they'll win.
How about Curtis Wilder and Beth Clement for Supreme Court?
Well, they're only loosely tied to the partisanship. I mean, they say Republicans are generally voting for the Republicans, but a lot of Democrats are generally voting for the Democrats, but a lot of people vote for incumbents. It's pretty clear that Clement is going to finish first, and I'm pretty sure Wilder will finish second.
What's going on, Tom? You've had polling that showed a 14-point gap, a pretty wide gap. Not too long ago. What's going on out there?
A couple things going on. First of all, there's sort of a realignment going on between parties, and that Republican Party is sort of becoming the Trump Party and the Democrat Party, at least this year, is the anti-Trump Party. And that's how things are splitting out at this point in time. And you're also seeing this huge shift among women that are moving to the Democratic Party that just can't stomach Trump. They're going out to cast a vote. You know, we asked in our polling, you know, are you going to cast a vote to support Trump, you're going to cast a vote to oppose Trump in this election? How much does it make a difference? It's minus 22 among women. Women are seeing things differently through this election on everything. And then the thing also is the Trump prism at this point in time. And they're going on, I think, overwhelmingly in voting Democrat.
Is this going to be a blue wave, or is this going to be remembered as a pink wave?
I think it's more of a pink wave, but the Democrats are benefited from it all. It's just really strange. We asked, a question in our poll on right track, wrong track. Among men, it's a plus 3 right track. The country's on the right track. Among women, it's a minus 30. So they just see that through a different, they're looking at everything through the Trump prism, I think, here. And it's really having a negative effect on the Republican Party and a positive effect that's benefiting the Democrats.
So, Steve, we've seen a lot of different results here on the gubernatorial race. We've seen Schuette down by as much as 14 points, and in some cases, 4 or 5. Why the variance? Why are we seeing that kind of variance?
I think all the polls were accurate when they were taken because polling is a snapshot. And I think it has been a very volatile electorate. I think that what happened is that the Republicans were gaining a lot of momentum. Tom, you did yours earlier than Bernie and Ed, and I did ours.
We were a week earlier.
And I think that week was a big week. After the shooting in Pittsburgh and after the pipe bomber, the Republicans just ran into a brick wall for a while. They're coming out of it now, but I don't think it's enough. Look, I still think the Republicans are going to retain control of the House. They're going to retain control of the Senate in Michigan, both of the Michigan House and the Michigan Senate. And I think that's good things. It'll lose 5 or 6 seats probably in both, but I think they're going to retain control. And they will elect, 1.5 Supreme Court justices. So I think that's a good thing.
Mark, do you think that the Democrats take the House?
I have no idea. The problem is it amounts to rolling dice a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. And I think that nobody can really know, because there are going to be enough seats that are close to 50-50 that they're more or less just a coin toss. And we're all going to find out at the end that somebody got lucky one side or the other. But we're reasonably close to split control. I mean, we're probably within 3 or 4 seats either way.
How volatile do you think that this election has been, as Steve mentioned here, with Republicans?
I don't think it's been volatile at all. The differences from one poll to another are largely explainable by just ordinary statistical variation. Because you've got a 4 or 5 point margin of error on any number, the difference between two candidates can be off easily by 8 points. And nobody has been more than 8 points from a number like Republicans getting 45% of the vote. right? So 45% plus or minus. I just don't think we've really seen the numbers wandering up and down. I don't think there's actually been much of a story. I think they're just random points, observations of a single pretty stable mean.
So if folks are saying that the race is tightening, the race is getting wider, you're saying it's really just remained the same this whole time.
I think that if the election were held at any point, the Democratic percentage of the two-party baseline would have been pretty close to 55%. Maybe it goes up 1 or 2 points, maybe it goes down 1 or 2 points because of events, but I think that we've always been on that track.
You're nodding your head over here, Tim.
Yeah, we had the same thing. We had basically the Democrats at a +8 to +10 in our poll. And so it's not just who's voting and what they believe, it's also, but it's who's voting, not or what they're saying, but it's who's voting. And you've seen this, million-plus voters coming out this year that didn't vote, 4 years ago. And they're not Republicans. They're not a majority of Republicans. A lot of them are younger that are registering. I mean, younger registration, I was reading in Mark's comments that, it doubled this year. So it's a new voter coming out there. Republicans have always done well in the midterm because Democrats don't show up and vote. I mean, if that's really been their benefit here. I mean, they did a pretty good job at getting out their vote almost every single election. It's pretty consistent over election cycles. But this year, Democrats, are not so sure if the Democrats are doing it, but people are getting out and voting, and they're voting more Democrat.
One of the things that I've been looking at this year is comparing this year to 2002 because it's historically kind of comparable. You were at the end of a long run of Republican governor. Dick Posthumus was down 8 to 14 points in mid-October, closed it to 4. That's not going to happen this time, is it?
I don't see that happening this time. I mean, I've read some articles that there is a silent red wave out there somewhat, but I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it in any poll. It doesn't show up any difference. I can see a realignment going on here. I mean, there is, especially in the suburban areas, in those districts, and especially in the suburban areas where you've got more educated professionals, whatever, which are at this point anti-Trump, moving over towards the Democratic Party is going to cause problems for Republicans in the House races, going to cause problems for Republicans in the two congressional races that are contested out of Oakland County there. Those are going to be really, really tight. And, so seats that should be +8, +10% Republican, they'll be lucky to hold both of those seats.
Was there anything that Bill Schuette and his campaign could have done differently to tighten that up?
If we looked at Bill Schuette's, favorables, unfavorables back in, say, March, and he was breaking better than 1-1. I mean, positive, negative wasn't overwhelming, great. But, if you look at what happened to him in October, his negatives doubled. And he really didn't do anything to deserve that except for the fact he aligned himself with Trump. And I think that negative backlash to Donald Trump is basically, it caught on with Bill Schuette, and he hasn't been able to shake it at all.
Let's get Steve on this. What about the Republican brand in general? Is there anything Republicans at all could have done?
When you look at what happened in the primary, I mean, he got hammered. Both Callie and Bill Schuette hammered each other. And he comes out of there with a 1-2, roughly 1-2 favorable, unfavorable. On the other hand, Gretchen Whitmer draws a lucky straw because Sri Tanadar gets in the race. If it's a two-way race between El Sayed and Whitmer, first of all, El Sayed might have won. But certainly he pushes Whitmer way to the left, and now he's pounding her hard in the same way that that Schuette's getting hammered by Brian Kelly. So I think Schuette had a difficult spot from the minute he came. Then you get into this decision. We want to hold our money till the end, but we've got to get our numbers up in order to raise more money to be competitive. And so you spend money early that you'd rather have spent late, mm-hmm. and that makes it difficult. But I think Bill just ended up with a very difficult position. And obviously, I think it's more than a realignment. When you look at elections, I think this is sort of 2006, where you had that, which is the real aberration in the last 30 years. 32 years is the race in 2006 when you had Democrats coming out in huge numbers. Except I don't know if you can compare it to that either, because now you have this whole Trump factor that they're sort of silent sometimes. Are they responding to polls or not? We'll find out. But where Republicans have tricky seats in the House and the Senate, they're Trump country. Normally, Republicans would be in trouble in Muskegon, and they may do well over there. They'd probably take the House seat, which would flip. There's a lot of other areas in the Upper Peninsula where, again, we might lose those seats because it was Democrat. Now it's Trump country. Macomb County, they won't have trouble there. That's Trump country. Monroe, the seats down there, they won't have where are they having trouble? It was sort of the country club Republicans in Oakland County where they could lose a couple of Senate seats and a couple of House seats that are strong Republicans.
I'd like to talk about realignment. I think there are actually two realignments going on at the same time. In the first place, this doesn't look to me like 2006, because that was, you know, the Democrats took a lot of votes, but then they receded. I think that what we're seeing here is a long-term, maybe permanent realignment of political views in America, and in particular in Michigan. And I think that the change in suburbia is not something that's going to recede. I think that upper-income suburbia, if it's not becoming Democratic, it's at least becoming competitive everywhere, because a lot of people are just changing party. It's not just kids replacing their grandparents, which is the normal process, takes 50 years. This is a sudden thing where people are actually leaving a party and other people are joining a party. And in places like Livingston County, which we can just count as being heavily Republican, there's not going to be much of a Republican margin out of Livingston County. Kent County is not going to deliver a margin for Schuette. I mean, I suspect Whitmer is going to carry Kent County. I mean, Bloomfield Hill is about the most Republican place on earth. And it wouldn't surprise me if Whitmer carries Bloomfield Hills, or at least comes pretty close. So that's one realignment. But there's another one, which is downscale, blue-collar, white voters who are permanently, I think, or at least long-term, lost to the Democratic Party. And so parts of Macomb and downriver Wayne, Monroe County, and so forth, long-term, I think, are walking away from the Democratic Party and are really redefining themselves.
Saginaw Bay City up in that area as well.
That's right. Increase in Republican vote out of Saginaw Bay City area for the last couple election cycles. And, Trump won, Saginaw County. I mean, when's the last time Republican won that county? And they're staying Republican all the way through this. That's why the House seats that are in those rural areas, small town areas, are pretty safe. They're staying safe because they are Trump country. We run the problems, as Mark said, is in the suburban areas, and you're getting this realignment. It may or may not be a permanent. Who knows? I think it's permanent among females at this point. I'm not sure it's permanent among males in the suburbs.
I want to ask you guys about response rates in polls, and we saw this with the New York Times poll. I guess this is where it really struck me, that they got a response rate of about 1% in their polls, which is horrendous. Steve, why is this? Are people not responding to polls like they used to, and why is that?
Well, yeah, they made 66,000 phone calls to get 436 completed interviews.
Amazing.
Which is, it's been going down for a long time, everything in this world gets cheaper except for polling, and polling is getting more and more expensive because it's twice as expensive to do a cell phone, and you've got to do more cell phones. Also you've got everybody hammering them. I mean, they're getting robocalls, they're getting ringless voicemails, they're getting whatever it is, they're getting hammered, and I think as a result of that, people are less likely to respond. I liked the good old days, didn't you, Tom, when you just...
10% response.
That's right.
We used to get 10% response on polls. But, the IVR polls, you're running into a lot fewer percentage. You're down to about 1.5%, 2% of people responding to those. Live polls, you can get a better response on it, too. But it's just real tough. It's tough, and when you do that, it's real tough to make sure you're getting a good sample of folks out there, not just those people who want to talk to pollsters.
Yeah, I think that this is a long-term trend in society, not just about polling, that technology is turning over all this power to individuals. And I sound like some sort of internet visionary, but I don't mean to here. But what I really mean is that people create a world around them that they watch the TV they want to watch. The networks don't tell you. 50 years ago, the networks picked what you watched. And a TV commercial that ran on all three networks, you could essentially force America to watch your television commercial in 1964 by buying all three networks at the same time. Today, that's an absurd idea. I mean, you can't make anybody watch TV. They watch, 100, 1,000, 10,000 different shows. They're available to them. People don't answer calls from their mother-in-law, right? Why should they answer calls from a pollster? I mean,
here's your quote of the day.
And so
I don't agree with that.
I always take calls from my mother-in-law.
Good for you. Good for you, Steve.
Well, so what I'm saying is that people are creating a world around themselves that they just assume that they're in control, whereas 50 years ago, it wasn't 10% response rate. In the 1950s, Gallup had a 70% response rate. Wow. I mean, Gallup would assign a number to be called. People answered their phone. And if you didn't answer the phone, they would call you and have a supervisor call and say, I understand you have concerns about this call. And a supervisor from Gallup Corporation would call. And if that didn't work, they would send somebody to your door.
No way.
Because they had a 70% response rate, wow. Right? Because they had chosen the person to be in the sample, and you needed to get that individual's response. Now, the New York Times has called 2.5 million people, and they get, 25,000 responses or 30,000 responses. You know, we're throwing nets into the sea, and we're going through cubic miles of water, and we just get a few fish out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Steve, is there anything to do with shaming? Are people concerned that if they answer, and they do answer, that the answers they provide may not be the answer the person on the other end of the line want to hear, and so they're not necessarily honest with their answer?
You know, there's been some studies that have shown that people are more honest to an automated survey because they don't want to tell that person on the other end of the line that they're for Trump, because if you're for Trump in this society, you are a misogynist, a racist, Islamophobic, you are any type of phobic you can come up with because of the fact that you are for Donald Trump. So a lot of Republicans and Trump supporters just sort of sit there, hear everybody harangue their candidate, and as they did in 2016, they get their justice on Election Day when they go and vote for their candidate or candidates.
Do you think there's something to that, Tom, that Republicans are not participating in polls, like purposely not, or lying to throw things off?
No, I don't think the Republicans are not participating more than Democrats on this. I think that there's always some concern. I think polling is going to have to move to some type of interactive type of operation in the future here, where it's a participation on both sides and not just going in and seeking someone's opinion. I think it's really going to have to change our methodology, and because you just can't keep going through less than 1% response on these phoning forever, and you never know who you're getting at the end. You're only getting those people who don't have anything better to do but talk on the phone to that person at that given time. You don't have any necessarily. So we got to figure out a better way so that we can get a representative sample and maybe make these things more interactive if we possibly can.
You're nodding your head over here, Mark, because you've had a little bit of a difference in your polling that you do.
We do a method for ballot proposals where we actually go door to door to randomly selected doors around Michigan. It's very expensive, very difficult, just a terrible pain. But even there, some people don't, we're seeing significant people who just don't answer their doors anymore. You knock on the door, you see them inside, they don't come to the door. So, I can't even by sending a canvasser there necessarily get it, but we're getting 35% response rate, which is, it's something. But I think that the long term, as Tom was saying, is that polling really has to rethink itself. The model, in my mind, is Amazon. If Amazon wants you to rate sheets, they have found a way to get you to give them honest opinions about which bath sheet you prefer. Whatever it is that they're trying to rate, by giving you something, by selecting a universe of people who actually care about it, they can get people to provide opinions. And then you develop a panel and you work with it. Now, the problem is that the panel may diverge from the voters, right? Mm-hmm. The voters may know less than the people who they've recruited in this panel, because the panel gradually becomes educated. So you have to then, there are all sorts of problems that are created by using this kind of a cultivated panel. But it's going to become necessary to do that over time.
Mark, I think you kind of touched on it, because that's where I wanted to go in terms of technology, because you guys mentioned the dynamics of people not answering their phones, not answering their doors. So I kind of wanted to ask you guys, how could technology kind of help us get that accurate picture of the electorate? Because I was talking earlier about, these days with advertising, it's all about consumer data. Is it accurate to measure people's preferences politically by what they click on Facebook and things like that? Is there a direction there in terms of how do we measure the electorate's position besides just trying to give them a call?
I think that you better not infer their opinions from consumer data. You better ask them who they're voting for, because anything that attempts to guess who they're voting for and compile that into a prediction, that has always blown up, and it's resulted in very poor accuracy. You have to come up with a way to get people to provide that information, and you have to acknowledge that it's valuable, that it's worth something to you, and so you have to give them something back. And that's really the Amazon approach, is, you know, you're on Amazon because you actually care about towels, right? And if you don't care about towels, then you don't answer the question. So if you care about politics, we'd like to know your opinion, says some sort of political survey. I'm not exactly sure how you do that if it's not tied to a commercial interest like Amazon or like Facebook or, you know, somebody who's got a bigger operation going. I also think, though, that it has to be tied, you talk about consumer data. The consumer data for politics is voter files. You've got to have links between the phone number you call or the internet ID that you got and an actual voter. You have to know who that is. And I think that random digit dialing, which people have fallen to, is becoming useless. The New York Times brilliant work that's being done this last month is all linked to voter files. They know who they're actually talking. They're not calling a random collection of phone digits. They're calling phone numbers that they've matched to a specific voter record. And once you've got that, you at least know you've got a person who is eligible to vote, they're living in the right district, you know some characteristics of them. So I think that we're going to see sophisticated kind of mashups of consumer information like Amazon with voter file information, and then we're going to see very powerful polling.
Going back to sort of the social media and the internet question, does the data issues that like Facebook had, I can't remember the name of the company that wound up with a lot
Cambridge
of data.
Analytica.
Yep. Does that make internet-based polling even more difficult because people are more reticent to actually answer any question with any honesty?
I think everybody is suspicious out there. What's you know, of social media, of opening yourself up anymore, because you never know what you're opening yourself up to. I mean, by giving your opinions, where's it going? Is it going just to this person who's accepting it, or is it going out to everybody and their brother? And I think that creates problems on using that type of social media in order to get people's honest opinions here. I think technically what we need to do in the future, one of the things is probably just oversample. And, we have that theory on IVR polls. I mean, normally is that we try to oversample as much as we possibly can and then pare it back down to a sample we think it represents whatever that district or whatever the state is. And that gives you a little bit more confidence level that you're not getting the 7-year-old answering the polls on the phone questions that you're putting out there, or somebody who's not registered or whatever, not telling necessarily the truth. But if you oversample, you reduce your percentage of potential problems like that. I think that's one of the ways technically we can help.
What do you guys feel about the possibility that some people are saying where James may actually do better than Schuette?
Yeah, I've got him in some stuff I did last night doing much better than Schuette. He's got momentum on his side. He's running against a 3-term incumbent. He did not come out of the primaries beat up by his opponent. So, yeah, absolutely, James will do better than Schuette.
Does he come out as the bright spot for Republicans in this election? And what kind of future would he have after this?
I think he's got a good future after this. I mean, he could clearly run against Haley Stevens if she were to win that 11th congressional seat, and he would be a very strong candidate in the presidential year in that seat. Again, you look at midterms, and the party that's in the White House doesn't do very well, but that may not be the case. So I think John James has a great future if he does not win this time, which I don't think he's going to do.
Let's move on to proposals, because polling proposals has been traditionally a little sticky. And Steve, I want to start with you. Have you done any polling on the proposals? And if so, what do you think is going to happen?
You know, my polling is, I haven't polled on the proposals now since October the 7th. So that's old news. I think all three of them are going to pass. When we do polling on proposals, we read the whole thing.
Okay.
I mean, all 100 words. And that's what it's my feeling is that's what the voter is going to see when they go into the polling booth, is that proposal, and that's what they're going to read. A lot of people know in advance, the marijuana people will say, yeah, I'm going to go and vote for that one. That's number one, and I'm going to do it. But a lot of people still will read the proposals before they go in. But my sense is that all three proposals will pass this time.
What do you think, Tom?
I think 1 and 2 are going to be really close. Neither of them have broken 60 in any polls that I've seen. And I just think that I thought 2 was going to be a lot more closer, but they've got this influx of money in on behalf of 2. There's $10 million to come in. There's not a whole lot of money being spent in opposition to it, so maybe that it still squeaks by. We've had, you know, marijuana, you know, for the last 4 years, I think up in the mid-50s, and but never really hitting 60% here. So I think it, you know, at the end, people, you know, when in doubt, they vote no. And it's really, I think it's going to be a lot closer than people think.
Mark, what do you think?
Well, I don't believe you can get an accurate answer for proposals by interviews, especially phone interviews, because I think it triggers a completely different psychological response in people that they know they're talking to somebody who knows who they are. In other words, it's not anonymous. And it's not that they're lying. It's just that they think differently. And so sometimes proposal polling has given the wrong answer by 20 or 30 or even 40 percentage points. There's just been tremendous polling errors, which you don't see with candidate polls. So we do this random door-to-door confidential secret ballot, you know, anonymous ballot, in which pretty well dummies a ballot so that people, when they voted, are voting something that, you know, really looks, it has the same feel as the ballot that they're going to vote on election day. And it's very similar to an absentee ballot. My numbers are basically that proposal 1 is probably going to pass, but, you know, it's close enough that it might not. Proposal 2 has actually taken like a hit recently from the advertising against it. It was polling, my numbers, pretty close to 70%, and I don't know how much it's dropped, but it's dropped some. And, you know, conceivably it could be in trouble, but I doubt it. And Proposal 3, which is the voter rights thing, nobody has laid a glove on, is just sailing away, and it's going to win 2-1 or something like that.
You think Proposal 1, out of the three, has the rockiest path?
I think so, unless the late decline I saw with Proposal 2 is continuing, unless that's like a snapshot of its descent. That would be my guess. And the thing that's going to buoy up Proposal 1 is that this large turnout we're seeing, we're all probably under-polling young people. They're just people who have no voter records at all who are going to be showing up on election day because everybody is just voting. I don't know. And those people are not anti-marijuana, is my guess.
Another trend that I wanted to bounce off you guys is the partisanship that we're seeing across the country. And we don't have straight ticket ballots this time around, Steve. As you know, we're not going to be able to fill in the ballot and everything fills in. But are we still going to see a very partisan election, do you believe?
We are in a hyper-partisan atmosphere and environment unlike anything I've seen going back even to the Vietnam War. I mean, my favorite is that you see all these Democrats saying, vote against hate. I mean, these people hate so much. They hate Donald Trump, and that's why you're seeing this huge turnout. I mean, there's never a doubt the Democrats were going to turn out after Trump was elected. The only question is, would Republicans turn out in equal sizes? And this is really an unbelievable hyper-partisanship. And, you know, I think there's no straight ticket voting. Mark made a point before we got on the air that people are going to go down through the ballots. We'll see. It depends on the weather. It depends on how long the lines are. You know, I timed my ballot, and I knew who I was voting for, and I did it as an absentee voter, and it took me about 14 minutes to complete the ballot. So you multiply that by all kinds of people sitting in polling booths, and it's going to be interesting to see how many people go through the whole ballot. They will probably because they, you know, everybody hates each other so much they want to stick it to the other side.
You did see that in your surveys, didn't you, Mark?
Right. I'm just surprised how bitter the divisions are in the ballots that I'm looking at. There just isn't any tolerance here for the other side. I mean, when everybody's sort of happy with the world, you can look at the other side and say, oh, well, I understand, even if I don't agree with all of them, you know, they all mean well. Nobody thinks that now. Nobody thinks the other side means well. Hate is maybe a little strong, but...
No, I don't think so.
The Donald Trump phenomenon, you know, as a 50-year political hack. I've spent my entire life in partisan politics. I don't talk politics to my relatives because they are so partisan. and they're so hostile to the Republicans. And I can't stand it. I find myself standing up for Republicanism. and I'm the only person there. I sold my house to people who are related to the Koch brothers, work for the Koch brothers, and a former campaign staffer for Trump in the East Lansing Flower Pot neighborhood. And my neighbors are actually angry about it. I mean, they are. You can tell that they are smoldering with resentment. And I keep telling them, diversity. You know, you have lesbians, you have multiracial couples, you have the only mosque in the Lansing area. You know, you have all those other forms of diversity, but you have no Republicans, and they don't think it's funny.
Does this, some of this of what you're talking about here explain Schuette's actions in this campaign? Now, maybe somebody's going to disagree with me, but I think if you'd watch the debates this year, which very few people supposedly did, Schuette almost looked like he was leading by 20 points. It seemed like he was the one avoiding answering the questions or avoiding making any kind of news. And you would think that trailing, he would be the one that would be wanting to hit her being Gretchen Whitmer on this issue or that issue that might kind of get something going. But was he just simply facing a situation where he had the Trump endorsement, but he couldn't really go there? He was reluctant to overplay that card at all because of this kind of polling you're seeing. And so does that explain why he sort of came off as just the person on there who really was trying to almost get the thing over with and not actually answer the questions?
You know, Schuette was sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place on this whole election. I mean, here he had a Trump endorsement, which was getting him nothing in a general election, but bad news, costing a vote. We figured about Trump endorsed cost about 9 or 10 points based on the questions that we were asking here. So it's a drag on him. Then on the other hand, you've got things going great in this state, but he's not tight with Snyder. So is he going to basically say, listen, things are going to stay, don't change direction, blah, 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 but he's at the same time, he doesn't want to give Snyder credit for it. Mm-hmm. And so there's those soft Republicans out there sort of like what Snyder's done, and they don't necessarily like Schuette at all. And because he doesn't think that, you know, that he has been fair with Snyder. He doesn't like the fact that he's had this battle with him. So, you know, he's sort of not had a candidate with a clear path for how to get to 51% on election day, if you look at it. I mean, I just haven't seen that in the debates, haven't seen it anywhere else. He has not tried to engage Gretchen Whitmer, hasn't get her to change her tune, make a mistake. I mean, he knew he was down the polls. He needed Gretchen Whitmer to make a mistake in those debates, and he just didn't do it.
Did any of you guys though poll the gubernatorial race on the issues, though? Because it seems to me Gretchen had the issues down much more in tune with the average voter that I talked to in terms of fix the roads versus the tax cut. And did that make a difference? Or is it just the demographics of where we're at?
Well, you know, Schuette was running on an economic plan, you know, and this, you know, paycheck agenda, which really I don't think did hit with anybody necessarily. And she was talking more of the, you know, the bread box issues, which is she's talking about roads, talking about education, things like that. And she had, you know, she had this, at the same time, she had this atmosphere that was going in her direction. You know, Schuette needed to change that somehow, change that into the point of putting her on the defensive at all, which he never did in this campaign, and she never took the bait the whole time, and he never really put her on the defensive all. So, I mean, she's got everything going in her direction. He needed to change it. He didn't do that.
You're running against history. Every time there's an open seat, the party that's in power loses in the next election when there's an open election for governor. And this, it's the same historical pattern you see in the presidency. In 2016, early 2016, I'd make speeches before groups and say it is very likely that the next president's going to be a Republican because, with the exception of Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush, the Republicans and Democrats have split back every 8 years going back to 1944. So, I mean, this is a long history of fighting it. And here in Michigan, you have the same issue you know, you've got John Engler is term limited out. It goes to Democrat Jennifer Granholm. She's termed out. It goes to Republican Rick Snyder. So if you knew nothing more than this was an election in which the Republicans were going to be leaving the governor's mansion, then you'd say that the Democrats were going to win. I mean, I think historical facts are important.
All right, we've got to put a cap on this, but some closing thoughts, Mark.
Well, I think that that we may see that history, that the future won't be the same as the past. I think that the Republican Party may be damaging itself so much in this election by poisoning its relationship to young people that they're going to find a very difficult electorate for the next 10 or 20 years, the same as happened after Hoover and the Great Depression. I mean, the Republicans damaged their own brand so badly that FDR and the Democrats became dominant for, 20 years. And I think that we may be seeing, because of the alienation of young people from the Republican Party, it may be very difficult for the Republican Party over the next 20 years.
Any other final thoughts?
We've seen these things come and go all the time. And if you look at 1970s, and where the young people, abandoned the Republican Party with Nixon and Warren and everything else, but they came back under Ronald Reagan, who offered them hope and things that they wanted to see. And so, these things will switch on. So whether it's long-term or not, we're not going to know. And for a couple election cycles, whether or not there's this realignment is permanent or this is just a Trump thing.
After every election, the hand-wringing begins. This is it. after Obama was elected, the Republicans, we're never going to win again, and the hand-wringing. And now after Trump, and now the Democrats were going, my God, Michigan has turned blue or red forever. I mean, this is the way it is. This is a midterm election. 18 out of the last 20 elections have seen the party that's in the White House lose seats. The historical precedences are still there. We just hate each other a lot more than we used to. And families don't talk to families. And you, God forbid, you bring up your political side if it differs from your brother or your twin brother or your mother or your father or whomever, because you're going to be in for a fight and nobody wants to do it. So you only talk politics with people that you know agree with you. And I've seen friendships of a half century dissolve because of the fact that one's a Democrat and one's a Republican. So.
Well, I'm glad we can all have a friendly discussion here in spite of all that. And thank you, Steve, for making the trek up here. Tom Shields with Marketing Resource Group and Mark Grebner, Practical Political Consultants. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Podcast. Jacob Kanzler, Jack Spencer, the boss, John Rurink. Special thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. And Dave Ackerley this morning for giving me the inspiration of the theme music. That was the biggest struggle, guys, trying to figure out what I was going to close and open this thing with. And Ackerley helped me out here with a final countdown. So momentous, so triumphant. Until next week, I'm Kyle. Take care.